Hello, and welcome to the Radical Thoughts podcast. In this episode, I interview Anton Yeager about Chantal Mouffe, her theories, and the rise of left-wing populism in contemporary politics. Yeager is a doctoral student at the University of Cambridge, working on the history of populism in the United States. Though he's going to be getting his doctorate pretty soon, so he won't be a student too much longer. He's contributed to Jacobin, the Los Angeles Review of Books, Catalyst, and numerous other publications. Right now, you're listening to 22 Ghosts 3 by Nine Inch Nails, but in a second, you'll hear us discuss Chantal Mouffe, Carl Schmitt, political antagonism, and the practice of contemporary left-wing populism. Anton Yeager is finishing up his doctoral degree at the University of Cambridge, and he works mostly on the history of populism in the United States. He is a contributor to Jacobin, and with Daniel Zamora, he is also working on an upcoming intellectual history of basic income, as well as also contributing to a future project on 10 years of populism. And I missed who your co-author for that project was.
Arturo Boyano, sorry.
Thank you for coming on to talk a bit more with me about Chantal Mouffe and her influence on left populism in Europe and the U.S.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So to begin with, I think we in the book club discussion I had with my co-hosts, we tried to kind of talk a bit about the milieu in which Mouffe was emerging. And around this time, the book we read, Return of the Political, her probably more well-known piece is the work on hegemony and strategy with Laclau. And this is around a time where they're kind of moving out of the outright post-Marxist kind of phase into developing this idea of just radical democracy as kind of its thing unto itself. Can you speak a little bit to kind of what this kind of work and this theory of radical democracy is responding to within the kind of composition of politics at the time that Mouffe and Laclau as well are writing?
Yeah. So I think there are basically two phases in Mouffe's philosophical career as a whole, which you again could classify as a first post-Marxist phase, which really spans the 1980s, which includes quite a lot of collaborative work with Laclau, which also comes out of her engagement with Gramsci in the 1970s, in which she first burst onto the philosophical stage, also in an Anglo-Saxon setting, sorry. And then you mainly have her own robust or sort of mature democratic theory early, which is not that strongly tied to that old Marxist discussion in the 1990s, which is mainly the post-politics and her own version of left Schmittianism, as you could call it. So I think those are the two most important phases. And I think both of those phases respond to a very specific set of challenges she saw herself as tackling in those periods and are also related to the different kind of enemy she's fighting. So of course, like, this is someone who thinks in terms of enemies, but you can clearly see that in the 1980s, she's aiming for a different target than she was in the 1990s. So if we start with the first phase, I think the best way to understand her post-Marxist project in the 1980s is that it's an outgrowth of what you could call the Gramsci Renaissance, mainly in Anglo-Saxon setting in the 1970s. So as the notebooks by Gramsci get translated in the late 1960s and find their way into kind of burgeoning new left in the UK, she becomes part of this interpretive scene. She's one of the first people to actually take on Gramsci as a way to rechannel and to revive what they see as a classical Leninist left that is becoming untenable or that is losing its battle with history. And at the same time, I think her attempt at post-Marxism is an attempt to democratize Marxism. So that's the first phase. Insofar as there are two separate challenges she sees to Leninist orthodoxy in the 70s and the 80s. The first is the clear stagnation and impossibility of any Leninist or Stalinist strategy in these developed capitalist societies. So a lot of people diagnose this in their own ways, but she's one of the few, or one of the many people to see this, is insofar as like strategy that Lenin proposed in the early 20th century has obviously become untenable in our contemporary societies. Gramsci's analysis of hegemony shows us why, insofar as these developed capitalist states have proven far more resilient, far more capable of absorbing pressure than anyone is presupposed, which means that the classical Leninist group is now historically shut off from us forever. And the second challenge she sees is what you would call the decentralization of the working class as a subject of history in the 1970s, 1980s, and its joining or its kind of diversification with all these other social groups, which are often summarized as new social movements. So what she sees is that the classical labor movement in the 1970s is increasingly challenged by these new social actors that enter onto the scene, feminist, ecologist, post-colonial activist. And as she sees it, those two people or those groups can't really respond to those challenges from those new groups. So it's actually, she sees that double challenge towards Leninism and the new social movement challenge actually as an ideal combination to say what needs to happen is that Marxism finally needs to settle its cores with democracy and become fully democratic. The way to do this is to turn Marxism into radical democracy and basically become post-Marxist. What happens in the 1990s in that second phase, I think, is something rather different, is that after 1989, it's clear that historical Marxism as an organized movement and also as a state, you could say, dies and disappears from the scene, and a kind of liberal centrism actually spreads its hegemony across the spectrum. So even the older social democratic parties completely sell out to a consensual liberalism. And instead of democratizing Marxism, the task obviously changes then, because there is no Marxism left to democratize. So the question then becomes, we need to re-democratize democracy. And I think that's the second phase in her thinking, insofar as, okay, Marxism has left the historical scene, but that doesn't mean that radical democracy has actually run out. The main task is going to be restorative, although there is something valuable in that it's restorative, because we don't have this, to put it bluntly, old Marxist detritus anymore that hampers us from just doing radical democracy in the first place.
We kind of reflected in our conversation on the podcast the way you could read what she was talking about in connection to the what you mentioned, the new social movements. And kind of one of the things that we felt was difficult about the political content of her work in relation to strategy was this feeling that even though it's talking about democratizing democracy and kind of, you know, expanding democracy into social society as a whole, it still had this very intellectual orientation of kind of, we just needed the right people with the right theories to conceive of politics the right way, almost. And we kind of felt like there was a bit of an NGO-like quality to the way of thinking that was going on. And you mentioned, you know, that she's someone who thinks in terms of enemies or adversaries. The influence of Carl Schmitt is very clear in her work. But for people who maybe aren't that familiar, can you maybe go into a bit of how she thinks of those, of that friend, enemy, or ally, adversary distinction, and how she's kind of deploying that Schmittian idea in terms of democracy, especially since, you know, in Schmitt's original conception, it's much more about the sovereign kind of state rather than, you know, advancing kind of like democracy for itself.
Absolutely, yeah. So I'll get back to the NGO issue a bit later, because I think it fits into the historical story which we have to tell when we want to understand Mouffe's inspiration by Schmitt. But to just get back to the way she thinks in enemies, so as I said, there's a first phase and a second phase to her career. The first phase, I think the main enemy is an orthodox, stale, semi-Stalinized Marxism, which is clearly leaving the scene by the late 80s, while the enemy really becomes roles in liberalism or a form of mainstream Anglo-Saxon quiescent liberalism in the 1990s. But I think the reason she turns to Schmitt, which is really a product of the second phase, insofar as Schmitt is less present in the 1980s because he fulfills less of a useful role against the Marxists, because the critique of the Marxists is very much that they haven't really been able to become democratic. They've never been proper democrats, and there's always been this Leninist temptation to completely suspend democratic norms or suspend the democratic game and just seize power. But in the 1990s, as Marxism disappears from the scene, and she faces a liberalism that's extremely consensual and therefore seems to quieten and muffle social conflict or political conflict, she turns to Schmitt, I think, in a way to think with Schmitt against Schmitt, but mainly to tease out contradictions in liberalism. And of course, Schmitt has always been one of the greatest thinkers of the contradictions of liberalism. So for people who don't know him, he was a German political philosopher who first began his career in the 1920s and 1930s in the Weimar Republic, and who became very famous with a series of books and pamphlets, mainly published in the 1920s, and who has a notorious, you could say, liaison or a short episode with the Nazis, although he never becomes what you could call a full Nazi apparatchik. So he's definitely tempted by it. And at the end of his career, he describes it as, "I was infected by the Nazi bacillus, but I never became fully sick of it," or something like that. But Schmitt's very idea is to model a classical critique of parliamentary democracy and of a form of parliamentary liberalism, which basically states that the incapacity liberals have is to think through politics as an autonomous sphere in itself. So liberals have this perpetual temptation to reduce politics either to law or to norms or to economics, and thereby to drown the essence of what politics is in these other spheres. And Schmitt's main project is to say, no, there is something irreducible, untranslatable about what politics is about. And this is the distinction between friend and enemy, which is the kind of categorical distinction that drives all political activity. And what's important in difference to Marx's currents is that Marxism has a notion of enemies, or what we could call class enemies, but those class enemies themselves don't have an existential role in Marxism. So the point about Marxism is emancipation. There are obviously questions what you're going to do with the class enemy, but the ultimate goal is the utopian horizon you need to create for the universality of mankind. While in Schmitt, there's very much a sense in that politics cannot happen without enemies. If you have no enemies left, then there's not going to be any politics anymore. And the reason this appeals to movement mainly in the 1990s is because the form of liberalism that becomes hegemonic at the time, both in Rawls and both in Habermas, is very typical for its ideal of building politics about what you could call friends. So she said, like, we have a social contract. There is a consensual set of rules which everyone has agreed on. And this is the arena in which the game of the socialist played. And obviously, that creates the illusion of a kind of equilibrium or a way of completely pacifying social conflict, which Mouffe again thinks leads to post-politics or leads to the complete elimination of any type of political conflict, as Schmitt showed before. But the way she diverges from Schmitt, and I think this is one of the trickiest parts of her theory, which a lot of people sometimes look past, is that she doesn't want to think through what you call the politics of friends. But she doesn't quite follow Schmitt in this idea that you need to have an absolute notion of the enemy, which could potentially be exterminated. So where she concedes the liberals is by saying, it's true, politics needs to happen within a certain set of rules. There needs to be a consensus which governs all political actors. But at the same time, you need a degree of friction, or you need a degree of what she calls antagonism to actually make politics work. So that's when she says, Schmitt thinks in terms of antagonism, I think in terms of agonism. And antagonism is the politics of the enemies, what you could call is her politics of frenemies. So insofar as these are people who are my friends, who I'm obviously not going to hurt physically, who will be part of the same parliamentary game, but who are still in a certain degree my opponents, and therefore I have to see them as my opponents and not necessarily as friends. So again, she tries to build this middle road both between Habermas roles and all these consensus liberals, and the almost semi-fascist Schmidt option, which basically says politics is just about eliminating your enemies, while the liberals say this is just about having friends. She says, no, if we use Schmidt to destabilize and to undermine some of the presuppositions of liberalism, we can actually build a much richer theory of democracy as well.
The kind of way that the Marxist political project is collapsing, in some of these debates, it can come across as a bit like chicken and egg, where it's like, how much of this is with, for instance, in the UK, there's kind of this stuff going on about to what degree was a turn towards focusing on hegemony and stuff with people like Stuart Hall, who I actually like Stuart Hall, but, you know, was kind of taken in by, you know, going with New Labour for a while, even though he ended up rejecting it. But to what degree is it that just material conditions, to put it in Marxist speak, is falling apart? So people are kind of grasping at all these different things and trying to reconstitute politics. But on the other hand, you sometimes see people saying, well, people were turning to all these things with psychoanalysis and kind of vaguer notions of hegemony outside of maybe what someone like Gramsci kind of originally intended. And it had an effect on these political parties that kind of deteriorated their politics. I know there's a essay by Sivanandan, I think is his, how you pronounce his name, called All That Melts Into Air Is Solid, where he's kind of responding to the New Times and its relation to New Labour. So how do you kind of see the back and forth between, you know, on the one hand, there's a definitive sense that, you know, the relationship of a Labour Marxist-based project to the Orthodox or, you know, Soviet Union kind of stuff is necessarily kind of falling apart and breaking down because of first political revelations about what was going on in the Soviet Union and then the collapse of the Soviet Union, but also what were these political theories merely reacting to that, or do you think that they also had an effect on how politics maybe oriented itself for better or worse? Or accelerated some of these problems?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is a very, very large story, which we can take in all kinds of directions.
All right.
But I think the first point of entry really here is the reception of Gramsci scholarship in the 1970s, and a particular way in which Gramsci, mainly in the British setting, and also, as you mentioned, in the New Times or the Communist Party setting, in Britain, was interpreted as having an exclusively cultural notion of hegemony. So people have been returning to the notebooks more recently and rereading them, and it's very clear that Gramsci's notion of hegemony it means a lot of things in a lot of contexts, but it's socially quite robust. So it definitely means the idea that a certain social group is able to order the social game in such a way that it also plays in its advantage. What this means in a social setting is not just cultural or access to the media. It also means mass membership parties. It means certain institutional infrastructure. It means actually participating in elections. It means also being militarily prepared. So there are so many sides to being hegemonic for Gramsci that it's just absolutely impossible to say that this is an exclusively cultural notion. What happens in the 1970s, though, and this I think has partly to do with the dynamics of a certain academic industry, is that Gramsci gets read almost exclusively as a cultural theorist. So someone who recognizes the importance of the superstructure of culture for politics. So the idea is that basically, in order to achieve hegemony from the left in society, the most important thing is that you maintain control over what you could call the culture industry. So that means you have to have your own newspapers, but it can quickly descend also in what you could call a sort of soft power or PR approach to politics, where the only way you exercise hegemony is basically by having a very, very strong media apparatus or having a very strong media presence. And again, I think this reading of Gramsci is rational in the British 1970s, mainly because what you had is a working class that was culturally quite hegemonic. So this is what happened in the 50s and 60s is with bands such as the Beatles, but also with the massive influx of working class people into education and into the arts and into journalism. There is a real sense that although the working class has not economically become the dominant group in society, or at least not politically, at least culturally, there's a real sense in which, yes, British culture or parts of mainstream British culture have been massified. They have been voluntarianized to a certain extent. But the issue is that in the 1970s, this particular cultural victory of the working class is interpreted as a way of saying that only cultural hegemony really matters. And this is, I think, what leads to certain kinds of pathologies in parts of the British left that give this idea that the way to beat Thatcher, because this is where the challenge becomes very acute, is by beating her with better soft power rather than actually building these institutions and these counter societies that can actually counter her politics in a material sense. And I think Stuart Hall reflects the difficulty of this interpretation of hegemony in a very good way, both as his status as a grandfather to cultural studies, of course, but also insofar as he was quite enthusiastic about Blair in the early moments of the Blair career. Because Blair is seen as a modernizer. Blair is someone who wants to drag the Labour Party away from this old workerist, almost unionist base, which clearly is hampering its ability to speak to middle-class audiences, which Thatcher is obviously very good at. And then as Blair gets into power, Hall is quite enthusiastic. By the way, Laclau himself also expresses enthusiasm when Blair first ascends in the Labour Party. Once Blair actually makes his program clear and starts to implement policies, and as you can see, is not at all that anti-neoliberal, both Hall and Laclau have second thoughts and actually distance himself from that project. But what Blair and Hall and Laclau shared in the 1980s or the late 1980s is a clear desire to bury this old unionist, almost corporatist style of socialist politics, which they thought was never going to be able to actually get the Thatcher government out of power. So in that sense, again, the fact that people read Gramsci in that way was understandable, but it did lead to a very narrow, exclusively cultural reading of political power, which I think confused the left for a long time afterwards, because you had this idea that as long as you control the symbolic repertoire of a certain society, you have power in that society as a whole. But I don't think that's the case at all. And I think the last 20 years have demonstrated that in a very, very spectacular fashion.
It's kind of funny and ironic in a sense that the thing that bolstered hegemony in the UK was the existence of a real kind of already proletarian cultural identity, which I'm an American, but from my understanding, I've always gotten the sense that England, even today, it's still, there is a much more clear kind of, you know, workers' culture than you would see in the U.S. Kind of the idea of, you know, the history of the sort of Cockney worker kind of idea. I've always had the sense of, like, with Tony Blair, I mentioned this on the in the previous podcast where I was with my co-host, that like I learned a lot about UK politics in the 80s and 90s through watching Spitting Image, where they constantly nail Blair as being more posh than the Tories and wanting to get rid of the inheritance for lords because he's jealous that he's not able to be one. So there's this kind of, I don't know, maybe that was only evidenced in retrospect, but I was interested in how, even while he was becoming leader of the Labour Party, that piece of popular culture was critiquing him so heavily for moving to this kind of conciliatory rightward position that they saw as a betrayal of the communication to that worker's identity that was considered to already be existing at the time. Oh, go ahead.
The only thing I'd add is that Blair did solve a dilemma which was ailing the Labour Party and socialists more generally in the 1970s for quite a while, and also in the 1980s, which was that you had a what you call socially powerful organized working class, mainly in the unions, which found it very difficult to gain electoral and even constitutional legitimacy in society as a whole. So as you maybe know, in the 1970s, repeatedly the strikes actually brought down British governments. So this shows clearly that you don't have to win elections in order for you to exercise power in society. The issue is that if you bring down a conservative government with strikes, as happened in 1974 and 3, this also throws up the possibility that you're seen as constitutionally illegitimate, which makes it even more difficult for you to exercise a power on the level of the state, or actually to get to the level of the state. And what the Labour Party was seeing in the 1970s, 1980s, is that its base was becoming ever more concentrated among an old-style industrial working class, which was loyally voting Labour. But these new middle classes and the more mobile working classes actually found it difficult to find their place within the Labour Party coalition. So you had a dilemma. So either you keep your class pure, or your class basis as pure as it was, and you exercise union power, or you broaden your base and you have to get middle class people into your coalition, but therefore you threaten the class purity of that coalition. And the solution Blair offered to this in the 1980s and 1990s is basically say, like, okay, we'll get the middle class in by accepting part of the neoliberal program, and we'll give all kinds of presents to that old-style working class, which will still be voting for us because, as Alistair Campbell, one of the famous spin doctors that Blair hired, said, they have nowhere else to go. So there was a kind of working class, middle class coalition that was constructed by Blair in the Third Way, which allowed them to win a lot of elections. So it allowed them to overcome the trauma of Thatcherism, and it allowed them to gain constitutional legitimacy, which they had lost before. And the only issue is that internally, the way that Blairite coalition functioned is that the middle class was clearly on top and the working class was in a at least submissive or subordinate position. So you had the electoral legitimacy, but you also completely liquidated your social base and you got rid of the unions. And again, if you want to talk about Corbynism, Corbynism has had to deal with this Blairite legacy in a particular way. But again, I don't think we should underestimate the enthusiasm for Blair in the 1980s, both on parts of it, far less, so far as that he was the only one to actually offer a convincing answer to this particular dilemma at the time.
I've always gotten the sense too that in some ways it's not an unforeseeable trajectory with the way that Labour previously had actually been already attempting to kind of move away from, you know, the we'll keep the red flag flying here kind of message with Neil Minnick and stuff, already kind of, well, we don't want to appear as being like really radical, but we also want to, you know, be able to go out and talk endlessly about how Thatcher is horrible and destroying the country, but we also can't really produce all that much that like concretely will help. But I guess bringing it back to kind of the theoretical aspect, what maybe we can go into, I kind of just dropped it early on, but then moved into the question about Schmitt with the kind of NGOs and new social movements, or how that kind of mixed, dispersed political concept of, well, we have all these kind of more, you know, diverse and diffuse subjectivities that are all seeking out their own interests. And they all have a kind of democratic place in the political debate or political sphere for someone like MOVE that needs to be incorporated into radical democracy, because they'll have a radical end, but they can't be united as one subject kind of thing. How is this kind of working in reality and how MOOF is attempting to theorize it, and maybe how, maybe we can talk a bit about, you know, going into how her theory presents itself and maybe the weaknesses that are embedded in the actual theoretical position as we move into kind of talking about later how her thinking is more starting to reflect actual political projects that have emerged after her writing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think just to start with the theory in general, and then to move how this theory plays out in practice, although some of the pipelines between theory and practice for most left populism are not always as clear cut as we'd like them to be. So there are some left populists that have explicitly claimed her as a source of inspiration, while others have been more disavowing, or she has said that she recognizes her political hopes in some projects, although those people were never explicitly inspired by MOOF. So there's not a clear one-to-one correspondence between what she writes and what happens politically, but there is still a way of tracing interesting connections. But the first thing I'd say is that since she's from a philosophical tradition, which you could call the constructivist tradition, which has a ontology or a philosophical theory or philosophy of the social, which is squarely opposed to what we call a classical materialist position, insofar as it's very heavily focused on the way that reality is itself a linguistic product, or the way we conceive of the social, the way we conceive of social relations is so mediated by rhetoric, is so mediated by certain linguistic tropes, that if you want to model politics, you actually also have to think politics through this rhetorical angle. But this means that the social groups she sees part of her radical democratic coalition are, in a sense, not really social groups, because these social groups only recognize themselves as social groups once they've been rhetorically endowed with this status. So there you can see where the relationship within the leader becomes so immensely impossible, because there's a very strong sense in which there's no real social content to that group except for how that group really conceives of itself. So once a group sees itself as students, once it sees itself as immigrants, once it sees itself as workers, and it has linguistic consciousness of itself as that group, then it can actually start functioning as a social agent. But there is nothing specific about what Marxists would call that group placing or position within a certain mode of production, what kind of power it holds within a hierarchy of interest within a specific society. There's almost what you could call a linguistic positivism to the way she talks about the social, insofar as it's just about how rhetoric actually structures the relationship between groups, rather than asking what kind of power relations exist between those groups that actually go beyond rhetoric. So she abstracts away from the social relations in which all these different groups are actually embedded, and just says, these are how these groups see themselves. How will this play out when they actually meet each other in a political arena? Now, obviously, this is a critique Marxists have leveled at her. She's insufficiently materialist. She doesn't recognize that behind these linguistic names, there is actually a real sort of material power struggle going on. But at the same time, the reason her theory makes sense today is that there has, in fact, been a thorough decomposition of different social groups throughout the end of the late 20th century. So it's true that the disorganization of organized labor, but also the disbanding of all these new social movements that arose in the 1980s and 1990s, means that it's far more difficult to look at society and actually determine where different social groups are located. And so there has been disorganization, there has been this decomposition, which means that obviously MOOF's theory would appeal to a disorganized society, because once you have a disorganized society, it becomes far more easily, it becomes far easier to interpolate or to call on certain subjects that weren't there before. So, I mean, the classic example is if you're not part of a union and the union doesn't actually give you a sense of what your interests as a worker are, of course, if someone launches a certain political ad at you, or if someone pitches a certain message to you on a PR stage, you're far more likely to recognize yourself in that message because you're not embedded in that prior social structure. So in that sense, MOOF's truth, or the truth of her theory, only reveals itself in an age in which people have lost affiliation with all these classical social categories that structured mass politics across the 20th century. Now, the thing which happens is that in an age in which people no longer identify with those social groups, but still want to do radical politics and still want to practice a form of socialist politics that was popular in the 20th century, you kind of get in a bind between the rhetorical side of your left populism and what you could call the material side of your left populism. And Podemos is the best example of this insofar as Podemos was filled with people who came from old-style communist families who had a history within the radical or the extreme left, who had what they call an experience or a lifelong trajectory of defeats, but who sense now that the classical way of talking about class and the way of talking about social groupings as the Marxist tradition did no longer had purchase on reality. Therefore, you had to have this more general rhetorical approach, which just sees a kind of diffuse people opposed to an elite, because they say this is the rhetoric that will work for us today because all those other Marxist categories don't actually work anymore. At the same time, the kind of policy they actually wanted to conduct in government was clearly what you could call Marxist or at least socialist. They actually wanted to enact a socialist program. So you get in a double bind where rhetorically you're actually not using socialist categories, but you do want to act as a socialist on a policy level. And that creates a double or a feedback loop insofar as you don't have a social actor available that can help actually help you enforce those policies on the level of the state. Rhetorically, you're actually not wedded to that notion of the working class anymore. And again, that's where the contradictions of Mouffe's discourse actually play out in practice rather than they do in theory.
With regard to this kind of split between the rhetoric and the actual political program as it functionally is attempting, what it's functionally attempting to do, one thing that we struggled with when we were reading Mouffe was that her position of radical democracy is clearly oriented towards a certain kind of socialism. It has a very vague way we found of talking about the state and trying to actually theorize how the state works beyond the general idea of like conflict in politics. And the kind of, you know, insistence on maintaining the advances of liberalism seemed not only to be a defense of like liberal, the existence of, say, democracy, representation, protection of like individuals, but this kind of idea that you can kind of just advance socialist interests without really having to like come into conflict with the way that the state in and of itself operates, which we, you know, I think most of us on the podcast were all, you know, at least critical. We're all generally supporters of, say, someone like Bernie Sanders and his movement, even if we had our own criticisms or critical support. But it kind of reading it in that post moment, even if we do, I think most of us also think it's good to have socialist programs and socialist movements attempting to operate and push for things in the state. But this kind, we were all kind of thinking, it feels like you need to have a little bit more, you almost need to have a little bit more of an adversarial position with regard to understanding the state in a class society itself, if you're going to be pushing for this kind of socialist interest.
No, absolutely. And I think this points back to the tension between liberalism and Schmitt that Mouffe is trying to navigate, which we discussed earlier on in the episode. Insofar as Mouffe is clearly dissatisfied with the liberal politics in general and parts of liberal doctrine, that's exactly why she feels attracted to Schmitt, who has the most convincing and, we could say, most strident critique of liberalism that's out there. At the same time, coming at it from a socialist position or from a Marxist position more specifically, there are some very big, big concessions she makes to liberalism in general. And one of those concessions is indeed her view of the state. Insofar as she doesn't see the state as structured by class forces or a sort of organ that has a relation to a capitalist society that's not removed from the dynamics of capitalism as a whole, but she pretty much has what you would call a liberal pluralist vision of the state, in which the state is like an arena. It's a theater in which different social forces or different political forces contest for hegemony. And the rules of the game on behalf of the state are pretty much neutral. It's just a question of how you create different constellations of power where one group can gain dominance over another. So this kind of neutral notion of the state as an arbiter above society rather than an institution which is completely implicated with the class forces which are working in society is one of the ways in which she is pretty much a kind of philosophical liberal. At the same time, again, I think her liberal view of the state is again a product of the disillusionment with the Leninism and Stalinism she was criticizing in the 1970s and 1980s, which she thinks was unduly critical of democratic possibilities that were buried in that modern state. So if you purely have a vision where you want to smash, you want to get rid of the state, there's no way in which you can actually do democratic politics, because any concession to that game is already a sellout, or it's already a liquidation of your historical program. But it is true in the sense that a lot of left populists enter politics with a clear notion of an enemy. They have an elite which they think is monopolizing or at least claiming the state. But then there is still a tacit assumption that you're actually still playing a game that's not rigged, or that's not rigged against you, where you can just win elections. And once you've won elections, you'll get into a position of executive power, and then you can implement your program. While previously, or at least in the Marxian tradition, there was a very clear sense that, well, no, I mean, there is a structural bias against you if you're doing politics from the left on behalf of the capitalist state. Your threshold of success is so much higher than if you're coming from the right. And if you don't take into account that structural bias, you're actually going to be running into a very, very large amount of obstacles later on. And I think, again, the experience of left populism speaks to that in they saw that, look, the state we're encountering is not at all neutral. It's not at all unbiased. There are actually kind of structural biases within the state against us. And again, if you buy into this liberal pluralist vision of how a state functions, it makes it difficult to reckon with these features later on.
One thing that I've always been, I mean, this is kind of just like a folk observation, a folk theory, but like the, I think one of the reasons that left populism or that populism can be appealing to the left sometimes is not only that, you know, people on the left, even in the US at least, even if you're not a Marxist, it's pretty easy to look around and go, wow, we don't have like a lot of concentrated, you know, organized institutions or anything. But you can see, you know, someone like Donald Trump or these other kind of right-wing populist movements that use this kind of general rhetoric. And of course they can use kind of just nationalist, generalist appeals to the people or what have you. But it looks, at first glance, like quite successful, at mobilizing and getting someone into a position of significant power. What do you think do you have anything to say on the kind of trends or history of how populism is used by the right wing, and kind of what might tactically separate, you know, how they can use it or their positions with populism as opposed to maybe what the left can do or the left's capabilities? And whether populism is effective for the right wing as opposed to the left wing.
I think there's a clear consciousness on the right of a dissatisfaction with liberalism that has spread across the spectrum and mainly in former working class areas, and what you could call the market opportunity that has been created by social democrats selling out to neoliberalism. So the right has always had this kind of populist edge, you could say, but it's become more expressive and it's become more open. And I think something like the Trump campaign, not necessarily the Trump administration, the Trump campaign really speaks to the right's capacity to actually capitalize on some of this populist anger that's been building up. And I think where there is a vague similarity with the left is, again, a capacity to speak in terms of enemies, or a capacity to dare to say the word elite out loud, to dare to point out conflicting interests within society and give up on the illusion of consensus. So in that sense, I accept a kind of structural similarity between populist challenges from the left and populist challenges from the right, in that rhetorically there's an emphasis on the elite or an anti-elitism in general, and a departure from a liberal belief in norms that could have been quite powerful, mainly in the 2000s. Where I don't think the comparison actually holds, except for sort of silly notions of red-brownism or the idea that the convergence of the extremes where Trump and Bernie are supposedly two sides of the same populist coin, is that it's exclusively rhetorical. Just because two people use vaguely similar terms, or two candidates have the same critiques of NAFTA, for example, doesn't mean you should place those two people in the same basket immediately in a concrete political sense. And that's what the word populism does, is that it equates the politics of Trump to the politics of Bernie purely because they had some shared grievances in the past, but which they never had the same policy response to this, or they never had the same political vision built around these grievances. Right. And what I do think is difficult to realize for the left is that it's very easy for the right to go populist, because their version of populism is not a very expensive one. It's extremely cultural. It's extremely cultural. It's highly symbolic. And given how low the redistributive ambitions of the current state and also the current population have become, any slight move to the left on economics, while completely ramping up the culture war register, will be interpreted as a populist concession or a sort of populist move on behalf of the right. So in that sense, the threshold of right-wing populists is much, much lower than on the left, because what the left desires is, in fact, a systemic change. And although the left has become better at organizing electoral campaigns, it's becoming better at actually reaching out through social media, there is an intellectually more vibrant and more healthy left than the one we had in the 2000s. I think that's a transatlantic fact, both in the US but also in Europe. At the same time, the kind of social power that the left had in the 20th century is still completely absent. Unionization is still on a historical low. And this means that once left-wing parties actually get into government, like Syriza or like Podemos, obviously that didn't happen in the Anglo-Saxon cases with Corbyn and Bernie, they find it very, very difficult to implement their program. Now, Trump made a lot of big promises on the campaign trail. He didn't actually make true on them during this administration, but it's not clear that's actually what he's after. The point is to keep the base active. The point is to give people the sense that an enemy is being fought. If after 4 years, people have enough sense that Trump, as this kind of bouncer, as Tucker Carlson calls him, has done the job, then they might as well vote for him again. It's not clear what the coronavirus situation is going to do to that, obviously, but I think there's a big, big difference between right-wing and left-wing populists, insofar as left-wing populists are still standing in that socialist tradition with one foot, while right-wing populists have a far lower benchmark as to what counts as success.
What, I guess, do you think is kind of the current state of where we're moving on the left, if we're in a populist direction, if we're moving out of one? And maybe you can, if you'd like to talk a bit about kind of your research on the last 10 years of populism, and what you think are some kind of good lessons to draw from our situation, and maybe draw from the history of this theory and what it's done and reflect, or and what it was reflecting on in terms of the conditions of political mobilization at its time.
Yes, so I think the big question that populism tried to answer in the last 10 years is how you mobilize for an age of demobilization, basically. Insofar as what do you do if all the big institutions of the labor movement in the 20th century have crumbled or have been legally ground to dust, and you still notice that there is an anger or there is a sense of frustration in the population with the current social order, and how can you channel and how can you rework that anger into something politically productive? And I think, as I said, I often use this phrase, like, left populism actually asked a lot of the right questions, unfortunately didn't have all of the right answers. So there was a clear departure from what you call the movementism or the sectarianism or even the anti-politics of the 2000s, which felt that just marching and protest politics, petitions, and almost sort of lifestyle changes would be enough to actually bring about large-scale social changes. So I think the world of Naomi Klein, the world of Negri and Hart, where consumer activism or even micropolitics was seen as a summum of left-wing politics. I think left populism rightly and beautifully left behind that wreckage. But at the same time, as the left got interested in politics again, I don't think everyone realized just how steep that climb was going to be. And there was an illusion that once you get into a position of executive power and you're able to do policy, you would encounter no resistance on behalf of powerful social actors who were clearly opposed to your program. Now, what you saw with Corbyn was even more tragic insofar as they got very, very close to an election victory, but then it didn't work out. But even then, if he'd gotten into government and he was faced with the prospect of capital flight or a full-blown capital strike, then there's still a question of, like, okay, what was it worth to get into government so quickly and not actually have any capacity for pressure once you're in government? Because you're just completely isolated alone in that executive position. But what you saw in the Syriza case is that Syriza got into power with a big, big promise, namely stopping the European austerity program. And then they found out that in the current European or Eurozone settlement, there's just no capacity to enforce any change if you're not able to change the German and the French position. And in that sense, left populism learned its lessons the hard way. Now that left populism is slowly disappearing from the scene, I think you can see a clear return to certain forms of movementist or even insurrectionist politics, which were considered like démodé or were considered out of fashion in the early 2010s. What I'm a bit afraid of is that people will not even acknowledge that left populism asked the right questions. And I don't think it did. I think it took politics seriously again, and I think we're in danger of actually losing that insight in the current wave of struggles, which arises out of a really, really righteous sense of frustration, but which has a very, very anti-organizational reflex, which I think might be quite dangerous in the long run.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Radical Thoughts podcast. Thank you again to Anton Yeager for appearing as our guest. I encourage everyone to check out their work. Our next book will be The Politics of Friendship by Jacques Derrida. Check it out if you want to read along. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time.